Welcome, everyone. Thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks, asking the question, why wait for heaven? On 1-2 Radio, changing the way we experience life and spirituality. Today is March 20th, 2015. On today's show, I'm happy to welcome back writer, graphic artist, and ACIM teacher Bruce Rawls. Now, there is a new moon solar eclipse today, and I'm ready to release the past and hear some inspiration about moving forward. How about you? And also, last week, it was Friday the 13th, and Bruce and I were talking, and he was thinking it would be great to talk about magic thoughts, which is kind of roughly what the Course refers to as our attempts to deny the truth and, in effect, to fix the world, fix our lives, fix everybody else. So that's kind of a simple version of magic thoughts. I'm sure Bruce will give us more about that. But that's what we're talking about, all those things about what we consider to be superstition or luck or determinism or fate or our mind's ability to really, you know, change the world or to do something, when really our mind's ability is to choose between two different thought systems. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And we also may dip into the text in chapter 23, which is called The War Against Yourself, where they talk about the laws of chaos. So those are some of the ideas we're going to talk about today. So while you're listening, I hope you'll join us in the 12radio.com private group on Facebook. And one of the easiest ways to get there is to go to that 12radio.com website. And on the left side of the page, click the chat button, and you will be automatically redirected to Facebook. So welcome, Bruce. I'm so excited about our conversation today.
Thanks, CA. Appreciate you having me.
A lot of great ideas, magic thoughts.
And I think your introduction really summarized it very nicely, because, you know, that we think that we have all these choices in the dream of our lives, but the only real choice that makes any difference is which teacher, which thought system we, you know, symbolically want to choose at any given moment. But that is hugely important, and that's what really gets us where we really want to be, unlike the shall we say, new agey paradigm approach of thinking that, oh, well, if I just can, you know, change enough in the dream or my thinking about the dream or whatever, that maybe somehow I'll be happier, and which is always kind of a losing proposition.
Oh my gosh, is it? Well, and you know, in some ways, I'm in an industry of magic. Uh-huh. You know, and on one hand, I wouldn't change that. I keep saying I'm in astrology, I'm in tarot, I'm in all these things because I like them, they're fun, and I do think they make life worth living. But on the other hand, I know it's still all part of the illusion, uh-huh. You know, but we're kind of in the business of making magic.
Well, actually, who isn't?
Yes.
You could really ask the question of if anyone really looks at their, quote, careers, unquote, or livelihood or, you know, anything that we do, you know, whether it's medicine or web design or working a jackhammer or planting flowers or coming up with the next awesome invention to help the planet. I mean, it's all magic. I mean, and why would we not do those things? I mean, why would we not continue to be as kind as we can within the context of what we think we are, all the while, if we really want to kind of escalate our undoing of the ego, to just look with a gentle inner smile at the things that we're doing and not make big deals out of them. So,
right.
Yeah. So, but yeah, it would be silly to say, oh, well, I'm, you know, going to forsake what I've learned and what I can, you know, do to make the world quote unquote better. I mean, why wouldn't we do those things? I mean, it'd be silly not to. But as we're doing them, it seems like we can look at the purpose that we do everything and the why we do everything, and that's where we can notice the magic of ego's strategy creeping in, and the manipulation of when we have an investment in trying to have things turn out a certain way. That's usually the warning indicator on our inner dashboard that says tilt, something's out of kilter here, because we're invested in the outcome. to mm-hmm. that.
Well, and purpose is everything. I mean, that's what I always pick up when I'm reading the courses, how often they'll say, ask yourself, what is the purpose? Mm-hmm. And I was even surprised. I was listening to some political news the other night, and somebody was asked to comment on something that had happened. And they said, well, what I'd really like to know is, what is the purpose? And I thought, whoa, maybe refreshing. Instead of just going in and rah, 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 about how bad it was or why did they do that? The person just said, I want to know what the purpose is. What is the purpose of that? And, of course, the person interviewing him was just like, well, I don't know. Divisiveness? I don't know,
And the divisive purpose is again, ego's magic strategy always. I mean, it's always trying to divide. But we can have, areas where we share interests. I think that's why Ken Wapnick in the Journey Through the Manual talks about, the two themes being trusting in Holy Spirit, trusting in that inner kindness teacher, or whatever we want to call that symbolic emissary of the remembrance that we have the capacity to undo the ego. And then the other theme is shared interest. If we can share an interest, it can be a hugely helpful thing to, look at our personal investments, what's it for me, with just a little smile and say, okay, yeah, I can take care of these, but if we can drop those back to just the minimal essentials and then really thinking, what can I do with the the time that I have to bring the greatest possible benefit, and asking ourselves, and why am I doing it, again, with a purpose in mind. That can be really helpful. The other day, we my wife and I went to go see the Imitation Game, which is about Alan Turing, who cracked the Nazi secret code. And one of the things that struck me is that even though he was in the portrayal anyway in the movie, very arrogant personality. He did have, again, because a lot of times it's not just a black and white thing. We're oftentimes choosing between those two thought systems in different ways and in different contexts. But in the movie, it showed how his character, when they cracked the code, they realized that the next target was one of the members on his team. Hopefully, spoiler alert, I'm going to give a little of the plot away.
That's right. Spoiler alert here,
spoiler
people.
Spoiler alert if you haven't seen it. What the Turing's character said, we can't contact your brother on this ship that the Germans are going to attack, because if we avert this, then they will know that we've cracked the code, and within a few days, they will have come up with another way that all the years that they spent in cracking the code will have been for naught. And so, he was basically looking in terms of the greater interest of, defeating the Nazi forces in this case, and saving the most lives, and in the credits at the roll at the end of the film, something like 14 million lives were estimated to have been saved by the work that they did in cracking that code. So non-trivial kind of stuff, and yet the even still within that, it's all about there was still the division of the we versus they. But the shared interest, I think, when we can extend that to include everyone, that's when it really makes the huge difference. And that's when we can use our magic abilities mm-hmm. without taking them quite so seriously, but also remembering that we can use them guided by the principle of, is this for myself only, or is this for all concerned? And am I excluding anyone from my thoughts of kindness and well-meaning, that kind of thing?
Right, right. Well, and I'm thinking so often when the Course talks about magic too, they're talking about what we consider healing methodologies.
Right.
And yet, I can't quote this, but it says, it's kind of the worst kind of denial at all to act like you're not living in this universe. So that if the aspirin, if the surgery, if the acupuncture, whatever it is, if it makes you feel better, then of course you ought to use it. And of course you ought to extend that to other people. And of course you ought to make other people feel better by offering that service. You just don't get confused that that's where healing needs to occur. Because of course, that's the other thing I go back to, and I don't know if it's helpful, but sometimes when something is going on for me, I go, but you know, the real healing needs to be in the mind.
Exactly.
So CA, you know, because even in the course somewhere, it says using the body lovelessly. Mm-hmm. And I always think about that. I'm like, okay, what exactly am I doing using my body lovelessly? Uh-huh. You know, how am I doing that? Or how did you, because you know, I'm a big person on how, but I sometimes do kind of just come back and go, well, you know, the real healing needs to be in the mind. And, you know, in the meantime, take the aspirin, make yourself feel better. But the real healing is in the mind. So is there something here that you need to look at, you know, rather than going to the magic cure? We're always looking for the magic cure.
Right. And like you say, there's nothing wrong with doing the magic. I think the quote that you were referring to, I'm going to probably paraphrase it too, but something to the effect of the denial of your physical experience is a most unworthy form of denial.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that's true, because another quote that Ken Wapnick, I find really helpful is, you know, that we vastly underestimate our identification with, you know, our bodies and our personas and the material form that we have essentially done an incredible acting job and convinced ourselves that we're actually the dream figure rather than the dreamer.
Right.
And because of that, it's very appropriate to do the things that correspond to our belief systems that make us feel less fearful and allow us to undo the ego in a way that doesn't, you know, as the course says, plunge us deeper into panic. And that's also, again, paraphrased, but mm-hmm. but every time that we do something that reflects kindness in our minds, which may very much look like magic, that can easily be a way to gently lead ourselves out of mindlessness, to lead us back to a mindful state, to where we say, oh yeah, I recognize that, you know, the aspirin isn't really doing the cure. It's my belief about it, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I'll take an aspirin too.
That's right. Well, you know, I always say it's hard to be self-actualized. I mean, if you kind of go back to Maslow's, you know, rules, it's kind of hard to be self-actualized when you're hungry or you don't have a place to sleep and you're tired and you're, you know, if you have all these physical needs, it's really hard, I think, sometimes to even go into those spiritual realms and to, right. you know, to do a meditation or do something like that. You take care of the immediate thing
yes.
to make you, you know, so that you can focus or so that you can concentrate on something else.
Right, right. I think that's also why in Gary Renard's third book, he actually has a chapter on, you know, things you can do to kind of keep the ego busy, keep it occupied. And, you know, so they're sort of, you know, health regimen kind of things.
I was going to say, and what are those?
Let's see, do I have the book handy? Actually, I do have it. It's sitting in front of me. I didn't realize it's covered in the book. It's, let's see if we can find the chapter really quick here.
That's funny because I was just watching a show the other day where somebody was heartbroken and somebody else said, well, you've got to give him something to do.
Yeah.
If you just give him a task, just tell him, ask him to do something for you because that will take their mind off of it.
It is. It's actually chapter 4 in Gary's third book, Love is Forgotten, Know and the Answer to Life, Gary Renard's book. And the chapter is entitled Bodily Healing for an Enlightened Mind. And then there's like a dozen kind of examples of things you can do that might be helpful, you know, just kind of, most of it's kind of common sense, but there's a few things that I hadn't heard of. So it's all about, you know, belief systems and magic and why not do the things that help us feel better again. So it basically gives the ego busy work so that we can then free our mind up to say, okay, now I really can spend the bulk of my time and in a predominantly greater amount over, you know, as cumulatively of thinking about what is my, you know, what's my unconscious resistance here. And the more we look at it with the Holy Spirit, the more we look at it and just see, oh, this doesn't have to be an issue because I can see where it originated from a fear of the happiness and the unchanging peace that comes from an identity that that doesn't have change in its vocabulary, doesn't have differences in its vocabulary or separation, that then becomes a way that we can undo the ego by forgiving ourselves for all those things, including the magic stuff, and just saying it's silly. Because if the central idea the Course attempts to teach is that there is no world, which is a lot to swallow, speaking of pills and,
right,
and other magic supplements. If that's true, then anything that we do in this world is magic. Breathing is magic. Drinking water is magic. You know, a heartbeat is doing the things to keep your heart beating. I mean, those are all magic things.
Right. At least according to the definition of the Course.
Yes, yes, yes. Maybe we could read some of the, in the Manual for Teachers, there's the first paragraph on how do God's teachers deal with magic thoughts.
Oh, good. Yes, yeah, that's great.
Because there's a lot in there, and it starts out, this is a crucial question for both teacher and pupil. And of course, we're all both. And when you introduce me as teacher, I'm thinking, yeah, I guess, but I think of myself as a student.
Well, but if you're a student, then you're a teacher. You're teaching what you're learning.
Exactly. We're always doing that. Everyone's a teacher and a student simultaneously. So anyway, yes. So meanwhile, back at the commentary.
Back at the ranch.
If this issue is mishandled, the teacher of God has hurt himself and has also attacked his pupil. This strengthens fear and makes the magic seem quite real to both of them. How to deal with magic thus becomes a major lesson for the teacher of God to master. His first responsibility in this is not to attack it. If a magic thought arouses anger in any form, God's teacher can be sure that he is strengthening his own belief in sin and has condemned himself. He can be sure as well that he has asked for depression, pain, fear, and disaster to come to him. Woo.
Yeah, really.
Let him remember then that it is not this that he would teach, because it is not this that he would learn. I think that has a lot to do with overlooking what we think as individuals are the problems in the world. And also in the psychotherapy pamphlet, that one of the key lines in that jumps out whenever I reread that is, the healing begins, and I'm going to paraphrase it again probably, but healing begins the moment the therapist forgets to judge his patient.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you could substitute therapist and patient with any, two people in any relationship. And because that's really, because we heal our minds whenever we forget to judge our projections. And forgetting is kind of a nice word to say, to remind us that it's not a big deal when we recognize that the ephemeral, fleeting things, whether it's planets spinning around or people spinning around in our under our roof, or pets, or the things spinning around on the hard drives on our computers, or anything that changes. In truth, if we can begin to adopt sort of an astronaut's perspective of zooming out from our own little personal dramas and using that perspective that our inner kindness teacher just quietly, silently provides us moment to moment, then we can afford to relate to that identity that transcends space and time, that's outside of space and time, that then can look at the magic stuff that we do. And there's a lot of magic that we do
Yes.
Every minute of the day. If we look at why we do all the things that we do, it's like, well, I mean, that's magic, magic, magic. Oh, that's magic. Oh, that's magic. Oh, that's magic. And then just forgive ourselves for all of it, because we're not going to change the behavior, change the form as a solution. But what we can do is change the thinking that was the cause of it, change the default program, if you will, that the ego runs unless we look at it, that keeps us stuck in identification with the magic as being the important thing.
Right. Like getting up and having breakfast is going to keep you healthy, or
right.
Eating protein is going to keep you healthier, brushing your teeth. And yet we know in this illusion those things, in a sense, are true,
uh-huh.
But they just don't have the truth of reality, I guess.
Right. And there are times when we can suspend those things And I think they're excellent reminders when, you know, for example, you know, kids are out playing hide and go seek, and maybe you've had an experience like this, and you run, you find this, you just last minute, you think of some really cool place to hide and you scrape your knee, but you're so excited about,
you don't even think about it.
And then you get home and your parents say, oh, well, that must really hurt. And it's like, oh, dang, it really does hurt.
Yeah.
You know, but you hadn't noticed it for the hour that remaining hour that you played the hide and go seek, you know, that kind of thing. Or the, you know, the stories about, you know, the mom that sees, you know, a emergency brake fail on a car and the kid crawling up behind it and lifts the car off the kid and then realizes that was impossible and faints, you know, and kind of thing. Because, you know mm-hmm. there's examples of things like that where, you know, we recognize that our mind is actually more powerful than we give it credit to. But it, if we did that on a regular basis, you know, we would freak ourselves out. So
we probably would. Go ahead.
We keep it kind of tame, in other words, most of the time. And
yeah.
Get a gradual awakening.
Well, and I just saw Deepak Chopra just a few minutes of something he was saying the other day. And, you know, it was the reminder that nothing that we think is solid is solid.
Yes. So in the Copenhagen interpretation that Alex Marchand talks about in his book, among other interesting things in modern science and modern physics, my understanding was that several decades ago in the last century, when quantum mechanics and quantum theory was being birthed, the double slit experiment was basically the one that showed that things are both waves and particles, you know, electrons, photons, that sort of thing. And but what was the pivotal idea that was, I think, befuddling all of these physicists, you know, essentially the who's who in the realm of physics in that era, they kind of looked at each other and said, well, and the outcome of that experiment, which has been replicated many, many times, is that a particle will be, you know, an electron, for example, will behave either as a wave or a particle depending on the expectations of the observers.
So it can act as both?
Yeah. So that means mind is primary, because that's by implication. It means that it's the expectation of the person conducting the experiment that determines the outcome. Well, that just totally flies in the face of Newtonian physics that says that there's an objective universe out there that, you know, in this billiard ball Newtonian model, which works great for you know, a mindless universe. If, you know, as long as we're going along with ego's, you know, script and not questioning it, the validity of the reality of it, then you know, the billiard ball model works pretty darn well.
Yeah.
But the instant we recognize that there's a mental aspect, and not, it's more than just an aspect, it's actually ultimately, and I think it's where Alex's work is brilliant and reminds us that we need to turn it around to where mind is primary and matter is just a byproduct of magic thinking, essentially. But of course, most physicists aren't going to go that way, go that far. And they're certainly not going to talk, as Ken suggests, that ultimately will need to be addressed, is that the unconscious guilt is the reason for why the universe was created.
That's right, where we came up with all these complexities.
Right, probably not too many physicists are going to put their, especially if they're tenured professors, you know, or whatever, and are, you know, funding from, you know, certain institutions, they're probably not going to put those things on the line to talk about unconscious guilt. But in private, some of them might be willing to go there, and I think some of the more advanced ones are. Like John Wheeler says, you know, there's no out there, which ties in perfectly with what you're just saying, is that you know, what we think of as matter is really, you know, what physics now calls probability clouds.
Oh,
So for example, you know, an electron that might be in the tip of my finger, that I think is, you know, in the old model where you've got the little, like, planets orbiting the nucleus, kind of a model that we mm-hmm. learned in at least in the 60s, I learned,
right,
grade school. That basically is, well, yeah, that's a convenient thing for you know, just a first pass at it, but the probability cloud that electron statistically could be anywhere in the universe at any given time, and that by analyzing it and by, you know, observing it and recording it, you then lock it down to a specific place. So that's my understanding of, you know, that highly, highly simplified and probably not completely accurate, but I think it captures the gist of it, is that things don't exist until we believe them into existence. And that's also covered in Alex's book really, really nicely, that, you know, that if we have recordings of things, that sort of anchors them more in our minds. And so it makes them seem more real. So the magic then seems more real. But physicists also say that that same electron that's in the tip of my finger that I believe is you know, there all the time, you know, could be in a hair follicle on the top of your head, or in a piece of iron on the top of the Eiffel Tower, or, you know, yada, yada. You know, pick your spot in the cosmos, or you know, in some little dust mote on the outer edge of the Andromeda Galaxy. I mean, because statistically, it's probably more probable that it's going to be at the end of my finger, but it could be anywhere in the cosmos at any given time. So for that same reason, you know, the sci-fi stories about people walking through walls, well, all that would have to happen is the incredible space between atoms would be, you know, all the atoms would have to align in such a way that you could walk through a wall and out through the other side. But there's nothing in physics that says that's impossible now that quantum theory has, you know, given us that model. It's just that it's improbable. It's not impossible.
So. Yeah, I like that. And what did you call it? The probability cloud?
I think that's I'm paraphrasing what I remember from my college physics, but that's kind of the gist of the idea and things I've read subsequently. But
well, I kind of like that. I mean, I even like it just in terms of thinking, or in terms of thinking about the way life works. The probability cloud of whether or not this is going to happen.
And I think cloud is kind of a fun metaphor too, because A Course in Miracles also uses it as a reminder of when we are, you know, involved in magic. It's a clouded thinking, but we don't have to judge ourselves for it. We can look at that clouded thinking that says that there's something that's going to happen in this dream projection that's going to make me happier or sadder, and that's kind of a clouded judgment. It's kind of a a way that we keep ourselves in a state of fear, rather than freeing ourselves to recognize that the magic doesn't have any power over us other than what we give it.
And I like the cloud metaphor too, the way it's used in the course. I think it's in some of the lessons, isn't it? In the workbook, they're talking about the clouds, because we all understand that experience of, like, even being in a plane and we're in all this huge cloud bank, and then all of a sudden we come out of it and there's the sun shining brightly. Exactly. And I think that's such a great metaphor, that no matter what's going on in our life, how dark it seems, or, you know, with the cloudiness, the sun hasn't gone out. The light has not gone out. The truth has not ever changed. It's simply our perspective. We're in the cloud bank, and that's why it looks that way to us. And so I love that analogy. I think it's something to really hang on to.
It is. It's a beautiful analogy. And like you say, that it seems forbidding and seems ominous when you see the plane going into, you know, this dark cloud kind of thing sometimes. And if you're on a flight and you realize, well, the plane doesn't really care. It just goes right through it to the sunlight above it. I actually got a pilot's license years ago, and I remember there was, like, nobody flying out of the airport that I was flying one morning. And it was just like, you know, everybody, because there was, like, you know, a layer of about 1,000 feet of clouds. But I knew that this was when I was in Livermore, California, and getting a license there. And over in the Central Valley, just, you know, not too many miles away, it was nice and clear because I watched the weather. So the tower, I asked, you know, the tower, you know, what the weather is. And they said, yeah, it looks like it's clear over in Tracy, and confirmed what I'd, you know, heard. So I got in my little Cessna 150 and climbed up through the clouds and you know, the fog in this case. And sure enough, about 1,000 feet above the ground level, it was nice and clear, and I just flew out over to that area. And then, you know, by the time I got back, it cleared up, because it was just a morning fog kind of a thing. But I think that's it's such a great metaphor, because it can seem, you know, scary to go through the clouds. But if we know that what's on the other side, you know, is what's real, then, you know, we can have that trust to continue on through.
Well, and you know what I particularly like about it too is that I was raised Catholic, and I remember as a child, I was always one of these kids, as you can imagine, was questioning it. But it never made sense. The whole idea of the devil and Satan never made sense to me. And the reason is because, I mean, and it was such an example of a duality in the universe, because here's God and there's Satan, but they always seem to be equal. And that never made sense. I thought, well, if God is God, how could there be Satan? I mean, how could there be this equally destructive force? And yet, as you kind of looked around in life, it seemed like there was such duality. But then, you know, it's like the older I got, I just thought, no, that's not true. Like I tell people, there is a sun, but it's not like there's an equally dark planet that creates darkness. Well, there isn't. There isn't.
Good. I like that.
There isn't a planet that creates darkness. So you're either facing the sun or you're not facing the sun. And I think that's why I finally just came to, you know, I mean, I know we could probably argue forever whether or not there's a Satan or a devil, but it's like, it just doesn't make sense in our universe. It's like there is one light, the sun, and we face it or we don't face it. And it just strikes me as the same thing, you know, on a spiritual level, that there could be clouds or could be any reason you're not seeing the sun, but there is no dark force that's vying for your attention. I guess, unless we want to consider it to be the ego. But there again, the ego is nothing more than a thought system.
Exactly.
So,
I think the image that comes to mind of the great and powerful Oz on the screen,
yeah,
with the smoke and the flames, and you know, and all the special effects, you know, of the day, and of course we get more sophisticated in our special effects, but it's just a dream. It's just a projection. It's just a cloud that is obscuring what's behind the curtain, what's behind the facade. And like you say, there's really isn't anything to darkness. It's really the absence of light, and the absence is purposive, because we've chosen to believe in a dualistic system where it makes things seem, you know, horrible and evil and so forth, and within the context of the dream, you know, that's you know, a reasonable interpretation, but it's an interpretation. And I love what Ken Wapnick says, is that, you know, the way to get out of that interpretation is to look at your ego in a very calm, objective way that we can only do when we're accessing that higher, you know, awareness that we all have, that we could call our kindness teacher or Jesus or the Holy Spirit, that then reminds us to look at the stuff of our dreams and not call it evil or wicked or sinful, but just silly. It's just silly. I mean, in the same way that once you've gone through a cloud, you know, you don't say, oh, that was an evil cloud.
That's right.
Oh,
evil,
man,
cloud.
Damn that cloud. You know, it's just like, well, there wasn't anything to it, you know. But it can seem horrific at the time before you've done that once, before you've recognized it's your dream. I actually had an interesting dream years ago. It was one of the recurring dreams in adolescence and into my 20s where I was chased. This is a nighttime dream now, for clarification, where I was chased by this dark hooded figure that with his long saber. And it was like, oh man, it was like this horrible dream. And I realized at one point when I started learning about lucid dreaming that I realized, well, wait a minute, this is my dream. And one of the many recurrences, which was to be the last, I realized this is my dream. And I turned around and faced this dark cloaked assailant, grabbed the sword out of his hand, snapped it over my knee in two, and said, you know, and looked him in the face, which I still could see the face because there wasn't anything there, and said, don't ever do that again. And I never had the dream again.
Really?
Yeah. So I think we can do that metaphorically with all the demons that vex us, and recognize that it's just a way of looking at the magic that we've made up. I mean, they're on our payroll. They're on our theatrical payroll. Every person in our life, you know, we're the casting director. We're the as Ken points out in one of the audios I listened to, the theatrical manager of our mind. We can look at all the magic that and the special effects and all the smoke and clouds and fire and mirrors that we've hired in you know, this exorbitant budget to keep in place to keep us convinced that we're here, and we can begin to, you know, say, oh, that's kind of interesting, and gradually, you know, invest in comedies as a way to, instead of the tragedies in the horror films, to begin to see, well, you know, it doesn't have to be this big horrific deal that we make out of everything. And I think that's what perpetuates the magic, is making the big deal.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I was just thinking, what a perfect day that we're talking about this today because of the new moon solar eclipse. Uh-huh. Because if you think about it historically, those were really, really scary times for people because they had no idea why the sun went out. You know, why did it get dark? Why, you know, what's covering up the sun? And so for primitive peoples, you know, and even today, if you Google it on the internet, you'll find some pretty scary stuff about solar eclipses. And yet we know from a physics level, it's simply the moon. You know, it's simply the moon coming in between the earth and the sun, which then blocks the sunlight for us temporarily. And once we understand it, it's kind of like bad cloud. You know, it's not like, okay, bad moon, what did you do? You know, it's like we understand that just it's a physical phenomena of the earth and the moon and the sun all lining up. And so we can come away with a completely different interpretation when we don't judge it. We can reinterpret it, and we can repurpose, reinterpret all those people. But I love what you were saying, because in some levels, that's what we need to do, is just say, don't ever do that to me again. You know, I'm on to you, you know, in terms of, I mean, not really, but like in your dream, you just faced up to what the fear was. And you just said, I'm dreaming this, I'm making this up. So don't ever do that to me again. You know?
Yeah, we can pull the plug on it. Yeah,
that's a good way of saying I'm pulling the plug.
We can just, you know, take the knife, the old classic sci-fi movie knife switch, and just power it down. And, you know, and then the Frankenstein monster just, you know, collapses in the little bit of fabric on the lawn when we recognize it's just a, you know, holiday decoration that we inflated.
Right.
So maybe what you're saying in terms of, you know, the eclipse and everything, maybe we don't need to go out and sacrifice a goat then, huh?
No, were you going to do that? No, we don't need to go sacrifice a goat.
But, you know, we can laugh at that. But we have all these superstitions and all these things that we do that you know, if when you catch yourself and watch how much of the day is devoted in a typical day to the magic of thinking, well, I need to do this next and I need to do that next. And we've got our to-do lists and our bucket lists and our yada, yada, yada list. And it just keeps on going, you know. But if we can begin to generalize and watch ourselves, you know, once you see yourself within a more lucid moment, seeing that the magic is purposive and that it's designed to keep us enthralled by ego's stories, and it's you know, scary, scary stuff, you know, then we can begin to not take it quite so seriously. It doesn't mean that we change the behavior. You know, it's still, like you say, it's probably a good idea to, you know, find the best nutrition that you have for yourself and your family, and you know, do the things you can with, you know, your professional work life to you know, improve the quality of the people's lives that you work with, and everyone that, you know, your customers and clients and whoever else, you know, your business affects. And all those things, you know, just why would we not do those things? But to think that those are making us happy, I think that's what the origin of the magic, you know, that, you know, there's, because we're never upset for the reason we think, because we usually get upset because we think that there's something in the world that has power over us. There's something, something in this projection on the screen, in this cloudy mindscape, the goatscape of ego's projected unconscious guilt that is, you know, out there to do us in. And so it seems like that's a good reminder for me that the three steps of forgiveness that I find helpful is to reveal, release, and replace. And reveal when I'm involved in a magic thought that says there's something outside of me that has the power to make me happy or unhappy, and then release it by saying this no longer has that power, even while behavior may still be in place that looks like it does. There's a lessening or a loosening of the white knuckled grip in the mind over that thing having power over you, the more mindfully we can look at each of those magic things and gently laugh at the notion that it, the dream, controls the dreamer. And then the release automatically gives way to the replacement, because once you go past the clouds, the sun's there, and we don't have to do anything. It's done for us. And that's why in A Course in Miracles it says that, you know, the third step is done for us and doesn't require our participation. Because once we do the first two steps of bringing our projections back inside, then forgiving ourselves for the silliness of having chosen them, the undo process is complete, because it's automatically replaced by the sun, if, you know, to use your metaphor, because the darkness has been vanquished.
That's right. So your steps are reveal, release, and replace.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a nice little trio, the three R's.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It is. It's a very nice one. Thank you for that.
Oh, sure, sure.
Yeah. And before we close the show today, do you have any announcements that you'd like to make? Please remind us where we can find your blog.
Oh,
because
sure.
You were just saying about that wonderful interview that you've got up there. Would you remind us where we can find that?
Certainly. It's acimblog.com. And you'll find the interview that I mentioned with Alexander Marchand about his new book, The Universe is Virtual. And also previous week, I had another conversation with Gary Renard, which was a lot of fun.
Nice.
And we talked about the dreamer of the dream. And Gary is also right on fun. And then and I'll always be, you know, posting these conversations and everything else that seems like it might be fun or helpful for other course students. So.
Yeah. No. So why were you interviewing Gary? Was it specifically to post something to your blog?
Well, it was something we had done a few years ago, actually, and we kind of gotten busy doing other things. And it was like, well, let's do more of these. So and we'll probably pull in more people as well. This was just a one-on-one, that particular one. But I want to do more of those. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other announcements?
Oh, that's plenty.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Oh, it's always good to remind people about the Foundation for A Course in Miracles. I think they have an academy class going on this week, and or this month, certainly.
Yeah, I think they do.
And they always have wonderful material. I've been going through the frequently asked questions, been to the 300 pluses now, but there's like 1,300 of them. And I've been reading two or three of those a day, and they're just wonderful. So if you go to the facim.org, and there's all the Lighthouse articles and so many great resources that they have there, including, of course, the books and audios, and then there's YouTube videos. And so I'll always try to remind people of that incredibly prodigious and helpful, voluminous body of resources for course students.
That's right. And he's talking about www.facim.org. And it is. I mean, it's kind of got everything you need. There's an online bookstore. There is the glossary, in fact, that Doug Sparks was talking about a couple of weeks ago on the show. He was taking us through the glossary and saying that when he first started studying the course, he literally went there and studied all the terms in the glossary.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, now that's an interesting approach, you know? I kind of like that. Harkens back to my Catholic school days. But, well, you know, I thought, yeah, what an obvious thing to do. That's great. So there is a glossary. They just have so many things. I mean, you can read a lot of articles by Ken and other people. I mean, just go to the website. You can just get lost on it practically.
It's a good place to get lost if you're going to get lost.
Yeah, that's right. If you're going to get lost, you might as well get lost in those clouds, right?
Uh-huh. Exactly. They're symbolically, you know, like the course says, the forgiveness is an illusion, but it's the one illusion that undoes all
undoes all the others. That's right. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, and wonderful conversation.
Oh, thank you.
We didn't really talk about those laws of chaos. Maybe we can do that next time.
I think that could easily take up a whole conversation, yeah.
I think it could. And like I said, because of the eclipse today, I think talking about magic and how the Course defines magic is a really good thing, because I think that can be really confusing to people. I mean, even to me. And, you know, it just, once again, it just reminds you in life, when people are talking, you have to really listen to the context of the words, you know, to really understand where they're coming from. So in the course, magic means, you know, something a little bit different than we ordinarily think of it. You know, it does mean that sort of alternative thought that we can fix everything or fix the world if we just work hard enough, or if we just think hard enough, or do enough affirmations, or whatever it is. So thank you for introducing that topic today, Bruce.
Sure. It's a nice way to let go of ego's sleight of hand deception strategy and replacing it with the self-honesty of looking at it kindly.
Yes, that is. And, you know, actually, I want to say one more thing, and that is one of the things I was thinking as you were talking today, too, is One of my favorite phrases to myself is, CA, it's just physics. And what I mean by that is I have this tendency to get angry at things that, like gravity. I mean, you know, like I'll drop something and it'll break, you know, do you know what I mean? And, but you're just frustrated, you know, you're getting something out of the refrigerator and you knock something off the counter or you drop it and it splits open and the dogs come running and I'm all mad and I'm going, CA, it's just physics. You know, this is just, it just goes to the ground. It's not a big deal. The sour cream was not trying to mess up your floor, you know, or, you know, just little things. You know what I'm talking about. I mean, just, I don't care what it is. If it's something on the car or whatever, I will get all upset like it's personally doing this thing to me. And I just go, CA, it's just physics. You know, this is just the way the world works. That piece just did what it was supposed to do. That's its nature. So I thought I would just say that since we were talking about physics, because it really does help me when I kind of just come back to that and go, you know, this isn't personal. It's physics.
Not personal. That's a really helpful pair of words, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So thank you so much for being here today. And also to the listeners and everybody in the chat room, thank you for coming and listening and participating. And thanks to our producer, Scott Weaver. And thanks. I hope you will keep it tuned to 1-2 Radio today, because we have a number of shows where you can learn about numerology. You can talk to the animals with Lizanne. You can check in on the angels and the ascended masters with Kathleen later. And coming up next is this Through Line with Christine Dumaurier. So please keep it tuned here. And if you didn't hear the whole show or you want to hear it again, catch it in an encore. Go to the archives and you can listen to it that way too. So I will be back next week. But until then, relax and wear loose clothes. You have been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks on 1-2 Radio with my guest, Bruce Rawls, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality.